behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. As always, we are joined by our super producers. We've got Tristan After Dark McNeil.
After Dark, I like it.
Or the Midnighter.
Turbo.
Turbo.
That's maybe good.
There we go.
Yeah. After Dark's not bad.
After Dark's not bad.
Yeah.
So why have we given him this nickname today? Also, folks, he doesn't really learn about these until we're on the air.
Yes, it's already too late at that point, right?
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, I guess it's probably a good thing in this situation because what we're going to talk about today is a little bit of illegal street racing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a club that I ran across, and I don't even remember what I was searching for. Maybe it was just looking for some photos. I saw some unusual stickers on some cars, and I was curious about what they meant. And it kind of led me down this rabbit hole, I guess, this pathway that I didn't really intend to go down. But it turns out there's a great story here, and I thought it was something that we would share with you today. And Ben, I mean, you've dug into this just as much as I have now at this point. This blows my mind, this story. This is incredible. It's hard to believe that something like this really did exist, and it's the stuff of legends, really.
Right, and it's become enshrined in pop culture as well, which is something that we'll talk about a little bit later in the podcast. Let's set the scene. We are talking about possibly one of the most famous or infamous illegal street racing gangs in world history.
Yeah.
They are called, and I'm going to butcher the pronunciation here, they are called Mido Naito Kurabu. That's Japanese. That's terrible Japanese, but I can do a decent job for you, ladies and gentlemen, in English. This is called the Midnight Club.
Yeah. Notice the space between mid and night. That's important.
Yeah.
That'll come up later, but this is called the Midnight Club, and the Midnight Club was a very exclusive group, extremely exclusive, as we'll find out. But these guys would spend, and this is all surmised, I guess, because there's a level of secrecy, too, that we'll discuss.
Right.
But it's rumored that some of these guys were spending millions of dollars in order to get their cars in the proper shape to race in this, I don't even want to call it a series, race in this gang, this midnight gang, this gang that would race, on the streets of, around Tokyo, I should say, because, they covered great distances, vast distances, in this. And we're talking about cars that were doing, should we give it away, Ben? They were driving in excess sometimes of 200 miles per hour on city streets.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
City streets, highway. Well, highways that went through
public
cities.
Roads.
Public roads. That's probably the best way to say it. And, but the thing is, you think of that would sound like Wild West type stuff, right?
I mean, right.
It's chaos. It's gotta be chaos, but that's not the case. These guys were very, very strict, very, regimented in the way that they did things and the way that things had to be. And they claim, and this is a funny claim, the claim that, their own personal safety and the public safety was their most important focus in this whole thing, or maybe second behind, top speed, of course. But
uh-huh.
They claimed to be very, very safe, and up to a certain point, they really were. Man, you know what? We're probably, giving away too much right here at the head.
Well, let's start this way.
Okay.
Let's outline their origin story and what differentiates this organization from other street racing groups, of which there are multiple in Japan, right?
Yeah.
There are multiple examples. This is not the only street racing group in Japan by a long shot. So the Midnight Club formed in 1987. As Scott mentioned, it is far more regimented, one would say elitist, than many other clubs. That's one of the first differences. But one of the other big differences, they sort of cast aspersion on drifting and autocross. They were not about that. The only thing this club was about in terms of car performance was maximum velocity.
Yeah, so they wanted to sustain top speed for as long as possible. So they needed long, long stretches of road to do that. And it turns out that the area right around Tokyo, we'll say that it's between, I think there's a town called Chiba, and there's a town called Yokohama. And it goes all, I mean, if you want to just think of that area, with Tokyo in between, Kawasaki's in there somewhere, all the highway system around there, but particularly that route, the route that goes around the bay. So that area is, you know, there's a lot of highways. There's long stretches, of course. You know, there's straights, but there are also turns. So it's, but it's highway, so there's a lot of gradual turns. It's not, you know, like there's an abrupt right turn in there or anything. So the area is actually not a bad area to do something like this. And they would do it at night when the traffic is extremely light, if not non-existent, really, in some of the areas. But they would, it was very organized in the way they would start things up. There'd be three cars, you know, two cars that were going to race. Now, they'd start the race somewhere around, you know, like 60, 75 miles an hour, something like that, which sounds already kind of quick, you know, 75. But at the sound of a horn from a third car, that's when the race would begin at a designated spot. You know, whether it's a you know, line right before you get to a long straight or whatever. There were starting points, ending points that they knew about, and that was the end of the race. But the horn honk would signal them to go, and, man, these guys would go. They said that the average racing speed was somewhere around 190 miles an hour. Again, on public roads with other traffic, there's no shutdown of, you know, any, you know, other, I can't even call it civilian. I don't know, right. other traffic, public traffic.
Right.
On these roads. So they're having to deal with that. I'm sure that they got into, you know, some, you know, complications with, you know, the law trying to catch them.
And that's a good point, Scott. I mean, obviously one of the reasons they're driving so late at night is to minimize the chance of encountering pedestrians, civilian drivers, or law enforcement.
Yeah, yeah, true. But you know that those encounters happen, but they had an advantage over those guys, and it's that they had faster cars. We'll discuss that too. So, man, I think, so we kind of got like the lay of the land, I guess.
You know, right.
They're driving fast, where they're driving around the Tokyo area,
yeah.
Around the bay, that they would go long, long distances. They were all about maximum velocity, you know, top speed, sustained top speed for long, long periods
yeah.
of time. And, you know, to be honest, the cars these guys are doing this in, we'll talk about them in detail in a moment, but, they're street cars that were tuned.
Right.
And this is what a lot of people refer to as the golden era of Japanese tuning. You know, they're right in the middle of the 1990s, late 1980s, early 1990s. So they're taking cars that, you know, weren't that fast, obviously, from the factory, obviously.
Right.
You know, they'd even take, you know, Porsches and make, you know, hop them up a little bit so that, you know, they were capable of 200 miles an hour. And Ferraris and stuff like that at the beginning. But as this tuning era kind of came to be in the 90s, different vehicles like RX-7s and Supras and, you know, well, GTRs, of course, those were high-end cars, Skylines, things like that would start to enter this mix and be accepted by the group. And I guess we've kind of set the stage, I guess, with some little details here and there about
sure.
what it was all about. But, it's a fascinating group and there's a lot of secrecy. So to participate in this group, like to join the club, it wasn't an easy thing. Cause you might think, well, I got a nice car. It's kind of fast, but these guys had some standards. They had some certain characteristics that your car had to have and that you had to obey in uh-huh. order to enter this group.
So, do you want to talk a little bit about how people would join?
Yeah, sure. Let's do that.
All right. So, if you wanted to join this club, if you had heard the rumors, or perhaps one day you were coming home late on traffic. You heard a distant rumble behind you, and then by the time you blinked, you saw taillights, and you wondered, who the heck was that? You would have a lot of work ahead. And some of the first stuff you would have to do is work on your vehicle,
mm-hmm.
right? It has to, as Scott said, be capable of racing over 190 miles per hour. Or 300 kilometers per hour.
This is crazy. So you have to – I think the minimum speed that they required, it had to be able to reach 160.
Right, or 250 kilometers.
Yeah, 160 miles per hour. But they said that the average racing speed was somewhere around 190. And, of course, they pushed that above 200. I mean, like 200, 210 is the range they were getting into. Again, public roads. Can you imagine that? So, yeah, it's something that you have to really, really work on a stock car, you know, that comes out of the factory in order to get it to that kind of speed,
well,
that kind of power.
Well, it's a golden era of Japanese tuning. So let's say you manage to make it to one meeting.
Okay.
Because you have dropped thousands of dollars souping up your car. If you are allowed to hang out with them, you are an apprentice for at least a year.
A solid year,
and you have to attend every single meeting for a year to show you're serious about it.
Yeah, but that wasn't it, though, right? Like, if you span the whole apprenticeship year and you make it to every event, every meeting, every, you know, everything that they had to do, then you weren't assured a position, were you?
No, you were not. only 10% of the drivers would qualify for full membership.
Oh, man. And that is, okay, and even so, even if you make it into that 10%, you have to prove that you can handle that type of speed on public roads and be not a, again, I laugh at this, like, how can you not be a danger at that speed on public roads? But
right.
You have to prove that you're not a danger to the public and you're not a danger to other racers as well at that speed. You have to be able to handle the vehicle as a pro would, really, to become a member. And so how would they distinguish between, you know, like, who was an apprentice, who was a member, who was not in this club at all? Because people wanted to be in there. They wanted to claim that they were in there. You know, there's a lot of people that kind of are on the edges of things, the outskirts of things, and they want to pretend as if they're in the group, but they're really not.
No.
Yeah, that was a no-no in this situation. And, you know, a lot of people laugh at, you know, decals, right? When you put decals on your car,
right.
And they claim certain things, like, you know, that you put on an NHRA sticker on your streetcar, and then you're trying to drag race people at the light or something.
Uh-huh.
And people kind of laugh at that, or whatever.
Yeah.
But these stickers that they distributed to members, and it was a special issue sticker, you know, it had a certain look, a certain font, it was made a certain way, it had certain dimensions, all this.
Except no substitutes.
It had to be their club sticker. If you put that on your vehicle, that meant you were part of something, and it really did mean something. If you tried to put one of those stickers on yourself, if you had one manufactured, if you created one yourself, and you tried to put that on your vehicle, and you were not a member of the club, there were some dire consequences to that action.
Right. Your car would be vandalized is the most polite way to say it.
Yeah, some cars were burned to the ground because they were saying, you know, this is an elite group. It takes a lot to be in this, and we, you know, put everything that we've got into this. You know, this is not only our hobby, it's practically our life, really. I mean, a lot of tuners, a lot of master tuners, I guess, there in Japan were really into this, and we'll find out some of the members of these do own tuning shops, and that's kind of their thing. But if you were trying to pretend as if you were in this club and you were not in the club, you would definitely pay the consequences.
Right. And this spread their legend even further, right? The idea that essentially this secret society existed in the heart of Japan and would take vengeance upon those who disobeyed its rules. You know, this concept, I guess the best way to say it is it fascinated the public, you know, and racing fans in other countries as well began to hear about this. But very few people actually made it to a meeting because it was really – you had to know what you were looking for to even make it to a meeting.
I mean, it was a chance occurrence if you even saw these guys on the road or at a bus stop somewhere, a truck stop or whatever on the side of the road. It was like, you know, they met at certain times at certain places, but they're passing by it. 200 miles an hour.
Right.
And you don't know where they're going to stop and where they're going to start and, you know, where the meetup is happening. It's all very secretive. The whole thing is based on secrecy. Like, they were such a tight group. They didn't want everybody to be involved. They didn't want, you know, spectators to be in the way of things, I guess,
maybe.
And
they didn't want the cops to know.
Yeah, they didn't want the cops to know. So I guess the only way that you would really, happen across these guys is just by chance.
Or by a careful reading of the newspaper.
Yeah, this is clever.
This is my favorite part.
Yeah, so let's hear the way that they would organize these meetups, because even to the members, they didn't know what was going on until, I guess, maybe last minute, right? I mean,
right.
The week before.
To organize a meetup, the leader of the team would place an ad in a local newspaper in Tokyo, under which there are many.
Yeah.
And it would be in the classified section. And it wouldn't sound like a racing meeting at all. Instead, it's the subject of the ad, the ostensible subject of the ad would be something that the group had decided on at their previous meeting. So by word of mouth, essentially.
Yeah.
So you'd only know about this if somebody told you or if you were at that meeting. And then the team members could look up the ad and the ad would tell them the location to begin the race at the exact time. So an example of the ad, we have an example of it. What would it read like, Scott?
It would say something like, you know, small handbags at discount prices. For more information, I'm available for meetup at the Daiku parking area on Thursday between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. Thank you. And so it would have nothing to do with racing, but it would say the name of the place, the day, and the time. And it would be between 11 and 2 a.m. And, you know, of course, they all know exactly when to go. You know, it's 1 a.m. or whatever. It's going to be 1 a.m. at this parking, or they wouldn't tell them where. That would be the location that's given to them there. But they hide it in these ads that, you know, pretend to be as if, you know, they're selling discount handbags.
Right.
Or, you know, something that is just something that no one would ever look twice at unless somebody happened to want a discount handbag, I guess, maybe. And then happen to run across this group. But, you know, one thing, Ben.
Yeah.
We're talking about secrecy.
Right.
And we didn't mention this in the Apprentice thing that, or during the, yeah, I guess when you're talking about the Apprentice, it was a very limited group. I mean, we're talking like, I think at one point membership swelled to something like 75 members. But it was like 30 around there. 30, 35 was about the average.
Right.
For all the years that this was in existence. And, so it remained a tight group. And the secrecy thing, it goes even farther than you might think because they were so careful about not revealing who they are, what they did, or what, you know, the cars were about or anything that they didn't even tell each other what was going on, really. You couldn't ask questions. If you were in the group, it was one of the strict rules. Again, these rules and regulations through this whole series or group or club that you couldn't even tell other members anything about your car. You couldn't tell them how you were funding the vehicle, you know, like how you were able to spend in one guy's case, $2 million on his car. $2 million on a car to make it go, you know, 220 miles an hour or whatever it was. You couldn't talk about where you worked. You couldn't talk about anything, how you were funding your racing effort or what you did during the day.
Yeah.
It was an absolute no-no. It was forbidden to talk about once you were a member of this group. So secrecy was a big, big issue with them. They maintained that throughout the whole run of the club.
Uh-huh.
And it just kind of it trickles into every little thing that they do. We'll see it, you know, come up later as well.
It's a fight club for cars.
Yeah, and you might think, okay, well, why don't – you know, you got to believe that police are just kind of hanging out waiting for these guys to pass, that they're going to – you know, they're going to just set up traps because they know that invariably – They're gonna meet up with these guys and just be able to nab them, you know, like watch them come by or, you know, you're not faster than the radio.
Uh-huh.
So they're gonna catch them, right? Didn't quite work out that way for the police because there was something called the gentleman's agreement or a gentleman's agreement. And I think we should come back and talk about that after a word from our sponsor.
And we have returned. A gentleman's agreement, you say?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And this is, in particular, one that, well, actually there's two parts to this. And this is a bit of a sidebar, but gentleman's agreement comes up in a lot of different things. It's not just the one we're going to talk about today. So the one in particular that hampered the police was something called the 1977 Japanese Automotive Gentleman's Agreement. And, this is crazy. This limited the police vehicles,
right,
and supposedly all the civilian vehicles, you know, the public vehicles, to a top speed of 110 miles per hour or 180 kilometers per hour, which was a legal requirement, or I guess legal, I'm doing the air quote thing,
right,
set forth by this 1977 Japanese Automotive Gentleman's Agreement. And so the police are driving around in these cars that can't go above 110 miles per hour.
Right.
These guys go whizzing past at 200 miles an hour.
Nothing
really not
do.
A chance. Yeah. And by the time they get the radio coordination to get them down the road, there's still no chance of catching them.
It's,
I mean,
similar,
they don't know where they're going.
Trying to catch up to a motorcycle from a dead stop.
Yeah. And the thing is, this was set about because of a, okay, two parts of this, as I said, and I'll try to get through this in the most clear way possible, but the 1977 agreement was really, all about the Bosasuku guys.
Right.
Remember the old Bosasuku guys that we talked about? The bike gangs and the,
uh-huh.
I think they had cars also at some point, but it started out with motorcycles.
Yeah.
So the idea was that, you know, the Japan Automobile Manufacturers Association, or JAMA, J-A-M-A, suggested that the speed limiting devices be put into all vehicles. We're talking about, motorcycles and cars. And the top speed was going to be 110 miles per hour because the Bosasuku guys and girls were causing a lot of chaos on the road. They were causing some havoc because they were all about stirring up stirring up trouble everywhere, really. I mean, doesn't the name, I'll have the name somewhere. I think it means, Bosatsuku means violent speed tribes. And so you can understand that. Well, go back and listen to the Car Stuff episode on that. We did that in, what, January of 2015, I think it was. And the idea was that, you know, if everybody did this, if all manufacturers supported this idea, and they did, because they wanted to rid the town of this, you know, this chaos. So they said, well, let's make it so that no vehicle can go above 110 miles per hour. And it actually worked. It worked for a while until, you know, groups like, you know, the Bosatsuku guys were able to bypass all that stuff with tuning. Mm-hmm. And so were the car guys, I guess, the Midnight Club and, you know, other clubs like it. Again, Bosatsuku wasn't just motorcycles. It was also cars. But this gentleman's agreement that came about in 77 was not the only one to happen. There was another one that came about in 1989, which is also during the time frame that we're talking about here, because this group started in 1987. And in 1989, there was another agreement in the automotive industry. And this was between all Japanese manufacturers that agreed that no production car would have more than 276 horsepower. So the agreement ended in 2005, as we'll find out in a moment. But the whole idea behind these gentlemen's agreements is that it's not a legally binding thing. It's just an agreement, a handshake, you know, that does this. It's like
an understanding.
Yeah, it's on your honor. You know, it's like you know, we say we're not going to do this, and therefore we're not going to do this. And if everybody adheres to that, it works. It fulfills itself that way. I mean, that, you know, it doesn't have to be enforced because everybody just does it, right? So all these manufacturers had agreed to these speed limiting devices back in the 70s. Now top horsepower ratings would be 276. And they said, you know, the reason was because, you know, this is a country where the maximum speed limit is 62 miles per hour anywhere in the country. You can't go faster than that.
Yeah.
So why not just adhere to this and that'll work? So all the advertising and everything you'll see from that era up until about 2005, we'll say that, you know, if it's a high-end vehicle, you know, something that's, you know, GTR or something like that, or, you know, one of the Subaru cars, like a WRX, from prior to 2005, it's going to say it has 276 horsepower. And I've seen other numbers that say 280. So you might see it as high as 280, but right around that area, even though it's kind of, everybody, you know, give a wink and a nod that, you know, we know this car has 330 horsepower or whatever it is, but we, for advertising purposes, say 276 horsepower, 280 horsepower. And that's just kind of the way it went for a long time until Acura, or Honda, I guess, debuted the Legend in 2005, right? And it was with a 3.5-liter V6 Legend, or I think it was the Acura RL here in the U.S., that had 300 horsepower. And they just outright, you know, just blew it. They just said, you know, that's it. We're done with this this agreement. And then right after that, it was kind of like the floodgates opened up, and everybody else started, you know, saying, "Well, you know, well, we've got this NSX also." Well, of course, that's again Acura, but it's a bad example there. But the RX-7 came out, you know, with Mazda, and they said, "Well, we've got a 300 horsepower 2-seat RX-7 that's coming out." I think there were, you know, of course, NSX came out with a 400 horsepower version. Lexus had a 300 horsepower vehicle soon after. So as soon as they did it, you know, the advertising changed, and it's not so much that they really were doing anything different. They were just finally admitting to the public, we've been building these cars that have more than that, but we've been adhering to this, I guess we'll call it a silly gentleman's agreement, up until this point. It wasn't silly to begin with, but everybody knew how to get around it. And of course, the gangs like, you know, the Midnight Club and the Bosatsuku guys, they knew how to get around it early on as well. But they were the ones flaunting it. It wasn't the manufacturers that were doing it up until 05. These guys were doing it right in the middle of the agreement when it was supposed to be limited. And the cops were adhering to it, and that was the problem. They weren't allowed to do anything different. And finally, I think somebody said, we need to get the equipment out on the streets to be able to catch these guys. So they did up the police car horsepower and you know, get some hotter vehicles out there so they could catch these guys, or at least keep up with them.
So it becomes an escalating arms race of sorts.
Yeah, and I know that's a long description of it, but you had to understand that, like, why they felt they could get away with it and why they did get away with it for so long.
And partially why they were allowed to do so for so long, because this could have changed much earlier, but the fact that the public and law enforcement seemed to acknowledge the Midnight Club's high prioritization of safety.
Mm-hmm.
Like that had an immense influence on the timing of the agreement lapsing.
Well, the public kind of they revered them for this. They said, well, you know, this is a group that actually it's not like the Bosuzuku guys that are out there just causing chaos and, you know, like smacking the back window of my car as they arrive by at, you know, 120 miles an hour or whatever, you know, with a bat or something. Because they were causing all kinds of trouble, these guys. And they were just like swarming around vehicles and, you know, nearly causing accidents, if not causing accidents. Just general chaos, really. You can imagine. Just, again, listen to that episode, you'll hear it. Mm-hmm. But these guys were more about, you know, they're going dangerously fast and you got to watch for them, I suppose. But at 190 miles an hour, 200 miles an hour, you don't get much of a chance to react to a car that you see in your rearview mirror, and then it's gone. You know, then it's beyond your line of sight in front of you. So you know, if you just maintain what you're doing, they're going to go around you. They know that these guys are, I guess, if you want to say safe. I keep stumbling when I say safe enough, but it again, 200 miles an hour on a public road, that's hard to fathom, but it happens. I guess they trusted them enough to say, yeah, they can maneuver these roads safe enough. So I feel safe around those guys and not around this other group.
Let's look at some of the specific vehicles too.
Sure.
Right? Let's dig into the good stuff. So we talked about, let's let the badger out of the bag here, my friend. We talked about that vehicle that had over $2 million worth of mods and rebuilding on it. What was the Blackbird?
The Blackbird.
That's what they called it.
Yeah, this one was it's a Porsche 930. It's a 911 turbo.
Yeah.
And insanely fast. I mean, insanely fast. And if you want to look it up, I mean, you can search for an article called, there's actually a really good article on just this one vehicle and finding this car now.
Yeah.
It's called Finding the Midnight Racing 930, and it's in Speed Hunters if you want to get a good rundown of what that car is all about. But, this is the Yoshida Specials 930, which is a maroon colored 911. Again, rumored that there was, what, $2 million put into this vehicle?
Yeah.
In order to make it go faster than another Porsche that had set this record, a speed record called the Yellow Bird, I think. And I don't have the details on the Yellow Bird right now. That's a different podcast. But, yeah, there were cars like, the, you know, this Blackbird, and there were other cars that had names like that. But, you know, we're talking about early on in this series, or series, I keep calling it that, but a group, a club, gang. There were Porsche 911s, there were Ferraris, other supercars, you know, similar high-dollar sports cars like that. But then the tuner cars came in, you know, with the lower-end vehicles that had just dumped a pile of money into the engine development and, you know, making them lightweight and safer for the driver. But we're talking about, again, like Supras and GTRs and Skylines, I think, were in there, RX-7s. Just you name the Japanese manufacturer, it was in on this in the Midnight Club in some way, really. You know, there was somebody there to tune it and make it better and somehow get it up to 160 miles an hour minimum, if not up to 200 plus.
Insane. And again, nobody knows. Nobody except for this guy knows how he was able to channel this much money into this thing.
Well, there's other people that know, but they're not talking. See, that's the secret. That's the beauty of the secrecy thing is that there are people out there that will do this stuff and they just will keep tight-lipped about it. They don't have to brag about it. They don't have to talk about it. They know what they were capable of doing or what they helped him do.
Uh-huh.
He himself, I believe, the person that owns this vehicle, I believe, is a tuner. So a lot of that work is probably done in-house. But it takes a lot of work. There's a lot of collaboration that goes on to make a car go this fast. And they also, they would sometimes practice at a track, a local track, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a super speedway almost, really. It was a huge bank turn track. And you'll see a lot of photographs of these midnight vehicles, or midnight club vehicles on this, the super speedway. And this is owned by a guy that would allow them to go out and, I guess give it a little bit of shakedown.
Yeah.
And the track was called, and I'll probably blow the pronunciation of this, but it's Yatabi Test Track, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, they would sometimes reach, you know, again, almost 200 miles an hour on this track. It's a high banked, you know, steep incline banking on the turns. And unfortunately, the track was demolished. So it's not around anymore. I think the guy that owned the track, his name was Masa Saito. And I'm going to get into the history of what happened here in a moment, but, he died later on, I think, in like, I want to say in the early 2000s.
You know what, Scott? this is a perfect time for us to introduce a plot twist.
Hmm.
Because we've talked a lot about the formation of the club, its rules, its rivalries.
Mm-hmm.
But we have yet to talk about the current state of the Midnight Racing Team. And we will scoot to the edge of your seats, ladies and gentlemen, unless it's going to, you know, mess up your driving. And we'll be back after a word from our sponsor.
And we're back, and Ben, you had teased that we were going to hear about the current state of the Midnight Racing Club. Now, what's going on with them right now?
Nothing. They're gone.
Well,
they're the official organization.
Yeah.
The official secret society no longer exists, and due to the nature of secrecy in this organization, the former members are not going to talk about it.
No, but we know what happened.
There's
a specific event that happened in 1999, and they immediately disbanded after that. Now, this event, this occurrence, is something that, again, this is part of why people actually gave them quite a bit of credit. They said, you know, this is a group that sticks to what they say. They mean what they say. They say what they mean, and they did. They really did this. So what happened was in 1999, there was a group of racers that are out on the street, the Midnight Racing Club. They're out there. As they do, yeah.
Pursuing their rivalries in a safe, professional way.
Yep, and as we said, you know, the Bossasuku guys were also out on the roads at that time, and they had a bit of a rivalry going, of course, you know, because, you know, well, who's faster, that kind of thing. They're causing trouble for each other.
The Bossasuku ambushed them. They were waiting for them.
Yeah, so they're waiting for these guys to pass, because, you know, they create chaos everywhere they go, these Bossasuku guys. Or at least they did. I don't know if the current ones still do. But this happened in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
It was 3 a.m., around 3 a.m.
And the Bossasuku, the bikers have been drinking.
Yeah, so there's a drunk bike rider on the road, and he's going really fast. I mean, like 160 miles an hour fast. So he's driving recklessly, this Bossasuku biker. And he's driving recklessly down the road, and he's scaring all these other drivers, you know, on the road because he's driving so fast and, again, you know, kind of swerving in and out of his lane and just causing, again, just general chaos, really.
And that's a very this leads us to a very important part. So remember how he said that they would meet up? I get the feeling – they didn't confirm this, but I get the feeling they had mapped out commonly understood routes.
Mm-hmm.
But – the bikers aren't going to know what those routes are.
No.
So when a member of the club accepts a challenge from a biker and they're just racing each other on an unplanned route, accidents happen. They deviate from the roads that they usually – or the roads that they were planning to use that evening.
Yeah.
They accidentally enter a high-traffic area.
Yeah, the high-traffic area. And remember, they're going 160 miles an hour, approximately 160 at this time. So the Bossasuku rider loses control, hits a motorist, and causes this huge chain reaction crash. Now, the motorist crashes into the barricade, and he died instantly, unfortunately. The Midnight Club racers slowed down, you know, because they saw what was going on. They saw the traffic, you know, realized that they need to back down a bit. And the Bossasuku rider, of course, he perished as well in this crash because, you know, he caused the initial accident. So two people dead right there. Eight other motorists were hospitalized. The group itself had a policy that they had set in place long before this. Like in the very inception of the club back in the late 80s, they said that if ever it happened that, you know, if anyone was to die in the existence of the club, whether it's a racer or a motorist or was, you know, indirect or directly the club's fault, this whole group would disband. That would be the end of the whole thing.
Immediately and forever.
Yeah, and they did that. They did exactly that. So, you know, this was the first instance that it happened, and, of course, it was caused by, you know, it doesn't matter that it wasn't caused by a Midnight Club racer. It was caused by the Bossasuku guy, you know, initiating this whole thing, and, you know, they went into the wrong area.
But they were involved.
They were involved. That's right. There's no, I mean, you still can point fingers in this case because, you know, there's still, it's still an illegal street racing gang. So, that, you know, there's that aspect to it. But they did hold to their word and they disbanded immediately and that was it. They just, it's like one of those things they never talk about it again. And the members that were in the club then and have been in the club, you know, throughout the history of it from 1987 all the way through, was it 1999? Mm,
yep.
I said, they are very tight-lipped about it. Now there's a few people that, you know, will say, yeah, I was in the club and, you know, here's my old car and it's still got stickers on it and it's verified as an original, you know, Midnight Club racer. But they just won't talk about it. They won't talk about other members. They just don't feel comfortable sharing a whole lot about their experience in this club. It's very secretive right to the very end and right to today.
Right. We can, however, connect the dots. We can string together some clues. There's very, very compelling evidence that a lot of founders of famous Japanese tuning shops were members.
Yeah.
And that just comes from a couple sources. There are confirmed statements, which are few and far between, but like Scott said, they are out there if you want to check. And then there are histories of cars that have been seen racing in that time period and have the sticker and then exclusively go to one tuning shop or another to get worked on.
Makes perfect sense, doesn't it? That, you know, the owners of these tuning shops would be the guys that were in on the ground floor of this, because that was, again, this is the beginning really of the Japanese, not the very beginning, but it's really the heyday, the golden era of Japanese streetcar tuning. And it makes sense that the guys that were involved in this, you know, the ones that they were in on the ground floor, the ones that were the originators of the series and had these extremely expensive cars that had, you know, the best of the best at the time, you know, they were the top end of everything. They were the ones that, you know, still own the vehicles. They still keep them in the back of the shop. They're covered under, you know, a tarp maybe, but, or they're on display, but not maybe out in the front window. You know, they're in the back tucked in behind, you know, five other cars that, you know, you can't really see it unless you make an attempt to go back and see it.
Or they're in like these, wooden crates. Like where they put the Ark of the Covenant at the end of Indiana Jones, spoiler alert, and stamped on it, it says top secret street racer car.
Spoiler alert. Isn't it like 25 years old at this point?
I don't know. You know, it's people old. Get weird about it. Like,
right.
is it a spoiler to say that, Abraham Lincoln didn't make it all the way through his term?
Wait, what? Ben, how can you ruin something like that for me?
I'm sorry that I know you were watching. Yeah. That documentary series.
Now I know what's going to happen. Great.
Now, right, so it's like when I ruined the Titanic for people.
Wait, something happened?
No, it's just a romantic comedy.
All right. But honestly, it does make sense that, you know, the guys that we know were involved in this were involved in it. I mean, you can put the pieces together and assume that, you know, that's accurate. But to get those guys to really, you know, to expound on that, you know, to say like, you know, here's what happened. Here's the way everything worked. They're not going to do that. They're not going to also talk about, you know, exactly what they had done to their cars and what, you know, the other person had done to their vehicles. Even though they saw it, they never really were comfortable discussing that with anybody, with the public.
Yeah. And to a degree, I can understand why. Even just beyond the secrecy, the fact that people could feel in any way complicit in injury or death of someone else, you know, it weighs on you, even if you weren't one of the people in the car.
Sure.
So I can understand a hesitancy to talk about it even without the secrecy. This would make for a fantastic documentary. And we mentioned at the top of the show that this has become a incredibly influential organization.
Mm-hmm.
I guess posthumously, right? After its disbanding.
Well, sure.
It inspired numerous other street racing groups.
Yeah. Even some called the Midnight Club, which.
Which I wouldn't mess with.
I would not either, but, you know, so far so good, I guess. I mean, but they're, I don't want to say cheap imitations, but they're imitations that don't quite live up to the standards of the original, I guess. And even the way it's written is different. There's not the space in between mid and night. It's together. But they try to emulate everything about the club and do things in the same way, but it's just not exactly the same.
Well, they might be on a budget, man.
You know, looking at some of the cars, you know, these Japanese tuner cars that we see today that are trying to be like these midnight clubs or even, you know, they name them other things, but illegal street racing groups. You know, incredible vehicle. I don't think they're on a budget at all when you take a look at what they've got. I mean, they're some of them are pretty wacky, you know, what they do. I mean, a lot of LED lighting and, you know, stuff like that.
More like aesthetic rather than performance.
Yeah, and these guys, again, were just about, like, just pared down performance. I mean, it was like the cars looked rather plain if you want to if you can call them that. I mean, they had some minor things that, you know, allowed them to stick to the ground a little bit better, you know, some aero improvements. But for the most part, they were taking stuff off of their car to make it lighter and faster and slicker through the air.
Right.
So the cars that you'll see from the original group are a little bit, they're not disappointing. I mean, they're really cool cars. It's just they don't look like the modern cars that, you know, are capable of achieving 200 miles an hour. And again, these guys would do this for, you know, 20-minute runs at a time. They're going 200 miles an hour. There's not a lot of, you know, modern-day supercars that can do that. So I give them a lot of credit for being able to do what they did when they did it. And that's one other little, I guess, a facet of the story that I find really fascinating, is that you can't find a lot of footage of these cars on the road. In fact, it's almost impossible to find more than just a few seconds. I think there's a YouTube video that has maybe 30 seconds of footage, you know, shot with like a grainy VHS recorder, back in the 1980s of these guys driving on a public road at 200 miles an hour. But the reason for this, and I was thinking, like, why are there so few videos and even photos? There's a lot of photos of just the cars themselves, but not of them really in action. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because, you know, you gotta think of the time this was, late 1980s, you know, all the way through the 1990s. Not everybody had a way to capture what was happening, you know, on hand like we do now. You don't just pull out the device from your pocket and shoot a little video.
Right.
You had to bring out the big VHS camcorder and put it on your shoulder and shoot it. And if you didn't know where these guys were going to be or where, you know, when they were going to pass, the opportunity was over. You couldn't, like, you know, keep it with you and then just jump in the back of the van and then, you know, try to capture this. It wasn't that way. You didn't have an iPhone in your pocket. So even photographs, if you were lucky enough to snap some photographs of these things, there's a good chance that the people that, you know, were old enough to do that in 1987 and, you know, 1990, there's a good chance that they don't really have a reliable way to put those photos online today.
That's true.
So there's probably a lot of them that are just kind of hanging out in scrapbooks somewhere.
Yeah.
Or in, you know, someone's, you know, toolbox in the garage. Some great photographs, but there's just no way to get them online. There is, but they don't know how to do it, or, you know, have no way to do that, or no interest in doing that. Yeah, right. So,
but to have that scrapbook.
Yeah. And I know that's probably, again, an over explanation of what's going on, but you got to remember, cause I've been trying desperately to find, to find footage of these guys on the road in, you know, from the 1990s. And it's really, really hard. You can find, again, that 30-second clip, I think, in this YouTube video, and that's about it. But, you can find modern vehicles that are, you know, pushing the limits of 200 miles an hour on the highway. And you'll see, you know, little 1-minute videos of acceleration, you know, like from, you know, 62 to 210 or whatever it is, you know, in a Corvette that has, you know, 1200 horsepower. But it's not the same as seeing these guys do their thing, you know, in the middle of Tokyo, in the middle of the night, you know, what, 25 years ago.
You're right. And this is where we get to one of the most important parts of today's episode. Ladies and gentlemen, on the off chance that you happen to have any knowledge, first or second hand, of this club, of the Midnight Club, let us know. You can write to us directly. And if, frankly, usually we ask for you to write to us and tell us something that you think we should share with your fellow listeners. At this point, Scott, you know, I've been doing a lot of digging and listening to what you said, because there's not a lot of info out there. So at this point, if you want to just give me an inside scoop, I promise I won't tell anyone.
Yeah, sure.
No, I'll probably tell Scott, yeah. But I won't tell anybody else.
Yeah.
I am just so baffled by the success of their secrecy, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, how it lasted for so long. I mean, we're now 18 years after the culmination of this whole thing. I mean, it ended in 1999, and people are still tight-lipped about it. I mean, they know they were in there.
Right.
They know they're in that group, but they're just not saying anything about it. I mean, little bits and pieces here and there just to get you, just to get you hooked, I guess. And I even saw somewhere, there was a forum, and you'll run across stuff like this if you're digging into the Midnight Club, and I encourage you to do it, because some really interesting stories about individual cars are out there too. Again, that finding, you know, the Blackbird or the 930, the Porsche 930, that story is pretty fascinating. But you'll run across things that, like, people who claim to have an inside scoop on, you know, what's going on. And one person in one of these forums that I was in claimed to be kind of tight with, you know, some of the original members and said that every year they still have an annual meetup that, you know, some of the original members come back and meet up in a designated spot and still kind of do this a little bit. I don't know if they make an actual run, but they still have an annual meetup somewhere.
Yeah.
And again, completely secret. No one really knows about it, but this guy is spilling the beans that, you know, it happens. And I don't even know if you, can you trust that though? I mean, is that somebody just kind of, you know, being Mr. Big Stuff on a forum somewhere? You know?
Right, yeah, an internet tough guy.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, like bragging, like, you know, like making people assume that he knows more than he really does know, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that do that kind of thing, and I feel like this might be one of those cases, so I don't know. I mean, again, you wouldn't know unless you happened across this group of people that gathered, you know, at a truck stop or a, you know, just, I don't know where they would gather, really. I mean, it could be anywhere. It could be a racetrack somewhere. Who knows? Again, secrecy.
You might know. And again, if you want to write to me, I promise I won't even show up. I'll just read about it.
Sure.
I just want to get a, I just want to get an inside view of this.
Well,
man.
It's, I mean, to be honest, this is one of the more intriguing stories that we've run across in the last couple months. I know there, you know, we're constantly looking for new topics and things, but I really dug into this one, and I don't even know if I was able to convey enough, how fascinating this series is, or not even, I keep calling it a series, how fascinating this gang was.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to know more and more about it, but the problem is there's a limit. There's only so much out there.
Right.
And beyond traveling to Tokyo, and starting to do some real journalism, some real digging around, some real, you know, detective work, you're not going to find out a whole lot more. You just have to go with the bits and pieces that are online right now.
Spot on. And we hope that you have enjoyed this episode at least half as much as we've enjoyed trying to dig through what information is out there. We also hope that this functions as, you know, the entrance to the rabbit hole for you, right?
Yeah.
The first step.
Yep, and it is a rabbit hole because you'll start to find little bits and pieces here and there and dig around the forums like I did, and then you'll start looking up things like the gentleman's agreement and read about, you know, JDM culture, I guess, you know, the Japanese domestic market, tuning, you know, and the golden era of tuning and, you know, what that was all about. And it just seems like there's a lot of different really interesting side stories to this whole thing. It's not just the gang itself, not just what they did, but everything surrounding it. It's really interesting.
And you can find, you know, it might be worth our time to post a couple of pictures, maybe of the Blackbird, on our social media, where you can find us at Facebook and Twitter. We are CarStuffHSW on both of those. And you can write to us directly if you have a lead for me or... You know, I feel like that's a long shot. Or you have some thoughts on street racing in general, right? Because this is sometimes a controversial topic, right?
Oh, sure.
So do you think, are you, as we used to always say, are you for it or against it? Do you participate in street racing? And, you know, we're not recommending that anybody break any laws. But if you have a story you think your fellow listeners would enjoy, we'd love to hear from you. You can write to us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.